So welcome, everybody, all the mentorship students, to the mentorship Q&A with Dave Lindahl featuring Jeannie Orlowski. Well, unfortunately, Dave is a little under the weather today, so he couldn't join us on the call. So we have probably the next best thing, and that's Jeannie Orlowski. So she'll be here to answer any questions you may have, any questions that may arise from the boot camp that happened this last weekend. You definitely want to ask Jeannie because she is the expert. So without further ado, I want to welcome Jeannie Orlowski. Good afternoon, Jeannie.
Hi, Jermaine. Hi, Paul. Thanks for being with me. Sorry I'm on the call instead of Dave, but he assures me that next Tuesday he will do the call. His two little girls have had the flu. His mother went over and babysat yesterday and came down with the flu. And then today Dave's got the flu. So he's just not feeling himself. His voice is all scratchy, and he apologizes because he was planning to be on the call. So you're stuck with me today. Hopefully it's okay, and we'll have some good questions coming in. So I want to welcome all the new mentorship students from both Tampa and San Jose. I'm Jeannie. I've been working for Dave for 20 years. I'm the girl that helps them raise the money and get the deals closed, take care of the investors, help coach students here and there. And I guess he trusts me enough to handle his coaching call. So I want to let you know that there's a boot camp going on in New Jersey today that Tammy is at, and Cindy is at a boot camp in New York today. It's going to go on for the weekend. Jeff is in Jacksonville, and Lori Marie Hines is in Seattle for the immersion training. We have a high five for Rob and Claudia Roselle. I've known them for years. Rob is a swell guy. Claudia is, they've been married for many, many years, and they're still like newlyweds, the two of them. And they purchased a 70-unit in St. Louis, Missouri for $2,680,000. All the units in the property were rehabbed by the previous owner, so the property is in immaculate condition. He found the property looking for brokers on LoopNet. There's room for storage in the basement, and he'll be able to put extra charges of $50 a month for that storage. He also closed on a 96 unit in Illinois as well. And Dave just put a property under contract in St. Louis, Missouri as well, which I'm raising money for. I'm just about completely raised, but it's a pretty good property. It's 124 units, called Hathaway Village. Okay, let's get into some questions. Do we have an operator on the call?
Hi, Jeannie. It's Rashawn. I'll be your operator for today's call.
Hi, Rashawn. How are you? Sorry to hear that Lillian's no longer with us. She sent me a note
yesterday.
Yes,
broke my heart.
Yeah, she's a good gal.
Yeah.
She did a good job. We made a good team. Rashawn, could you tell people how to ask a question?
Sure. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have any questions, please press star zero on your telephone keypad at this time. Again, star zero for any questions.
Thank you, Rashawn. I'm sure we'll have a very good relationship, you and I, going forward. I had a great relationship with Lillian, and you do a good job, too. Okay, so the first question that I have that was sent in is, property I am interested in purchasing has a vacant apartment that they use to show the property. It's been vacant for many months. Am I right in placing what would be the collected rent for that unit in concessions for non-payment on the underwriting template, or should it be considered a vacant apartment? Well, it could be a value play. That's from Heather Halverson from Suffern New York. Heather, if the property is 100% occupied, take that model unit they're using and turn it into a rental. You don't need it. So you only use a model unit when you have too many vacancies and you really don't want to show anybody a vacant apartment. So they set up a model unit and they stage it so that people will make it seem like their own home and they've already in their mind placing their furniture throughout the apartment. But if you do not need a model unit, turn it into a rental. Another question I got was, what is considered a sophisticated investor? So the terminology for a sophisticated investor by the SEC standard is, I have such knowledge and experience in financial matters, and I am capable of evaluating the merits and risks of an investment. I just don't meet the income or net worth guideline. So an accredited investor, it has an income of $200,000 a year or $300,000 with their spouse, or they have the net worth equal to $1 million. If you're shy of either one of those two things, then you are considered a sophisticated investor. What I usually do is have people write across the bottom of my accredited investor form, sophisticated investor, but you may want to put a little bullet on your form that you create right underneath it, an accredited, that they will check off if they're sophisticated. It'll be easier than having them write it in. But that's what it is. They just don't have the net worth or the income that an accredited investor has. And just so you know, you're allowed unlimited accredited investors in one deal. However, you're only allowed 35 sophisticated investors in one deal. Keep that in the back of your mind, because not that you're going to have 35 investors in one deal, but if you are raising money for a portfolio of properties, you could. So remember, you can only have 35 in one deal, but unlimited accredited. Do we have any questions, operator, at this point?
Yes, our first question comes from Heather. Heather, please state your question.
Hi, Jeannie. Hi, Jermaine. It's Heather Halverson from Suffern, New York again.
Hey.
Thanks for answering my question by email. I have some more questions.
Right.
If that's okay.
All right.
Great.
Yep.
It's good to be here with you guys. So, you know, we are looking in Jacksonville, Florida. And we really like the market, but the market's getting really tight there. And so
yep.
I know that Dave has said on his home training courses that, you know, go for smaller properties first. We've never bought a property yet. And he said sometimes, you know, it's just better to start small and your confidence will get bigger and all that kind of stuff. So we actually just kind of started looking at some smaller properties, but we're not used to underwriting for them. So Don Goff gave us some rule of thumbs for smaller properties, and we have used them, but can we still plug everything into the underwriting template as long as we use his rule of thumbs? Can we still use that underwriting template?
Yep. We do have
okay,
an
great.
Under 20 template. How many units are you looking?
Well, we're just looking at, I mean, whatever we can find. But, for example, one of my brokers just sent me a bunch of, you know, duplexes and triplexes. There might be a quad in there to look at. She sent me a bunch of things to look at.
So, you know what I would do rather than use the under 20 template or the underwriting template with the rule of thumbs that Dawn gave you,
mm-hmm.
I would go on to bigprofitfinder.com
okay.
and put it into the multi-unit profit finder. because that can be for very small properties or very large properties. And I think you'll get a better idea of the cash on cash that way. Remember to save every page, too.
Save every page. Okay, good, because I'm not familiar with that. So I'll go and explore a little bit when I get bigprofitfinder.com. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, great.
And what I tell my students to do is look under the 75 mark. 75 is where the competition is going to be a lot lower because hedge funds don't look at 75 units. They look at the 150s and above or the hundreds and above. So if you stay under the 75 mark, your competition is going to be a lot less fierce than the bigger units. So if you can pick up a 20 or a 30 or a 40 unit, I mean, that's where the sweet spot's going to be for you. A 2 and a 4 and a 6. You live in New York. Who's going to babysit these properties?
True. Okay. Okay, that's a good point. My partners live in Savannah, so they're a little bit closer, but go ahead, Jeannie.
I was going to tell you to go on to the website Crexi, CREXI.com.
Okay.
And look for properties on there. They have a lot of mixed properties, small ones, big ones, 3 units, 10 units, 100 units. They go all the way up the gamut. There's thousands of properties up there.
Okay, great. Thanks for that resource.
Okay.
Jeannie, if I do, just play with a few of these and try to underwrite them, does the Trinity change for, a duplex and a triplex? How do I know if I have a deal?
Well, the Trinity is going to show it, but in those kinds of deals, you're not going to be syndicating. You're going to be doing a partnership with somebody. Or maybe you're going to do them by yourself, so you don't really have to meet the 10% or the 12% cash-on-cash return.
Okay.
So if you're doing a partnership and $100 is left after all bills are paid, you're getting $50 and your partner's getting $50. So it's not the same as syndicating where you're committing to investors that they'll get an 8% preferred rate of return before you take any money. So that's why we say the 12% cash-on-cash return is king when you're syndicating a deal. But if you're not going to syndicate a 2-unit, that'd be foolish. It costs you more than the property to syndicate it.
Right.
So you're going to take in one investor, and that investor puts up the money, and your job is to run with the property, take care of it, make sure it cash flows, the rents are collected, et cetera.
So basically, the cash flow is the most important thing on those types of units.
Okay.
Yeah. It's all about the cash
flow. If I'm getting a partner.
Really care.
Sorry?
So
sorry, Jeannie, if there's just a lag there, I'm so sorry. You start, and then I'm going to follow up.
Okay. So we buy on cash-on-cash return.
Mm-hmm.
So if the cash-on-cash return is 10%, you don't care what the cap rate says. You care about that cash-on-cash return, which is what you're going to be committing to whoever's going to put up the money, that you and he are going to split it. So every month the cash flow is going to come in after you pay all the bills. Whatever's left over is a 50-50 split with whoever puts up the money.
Okay. So it's basically, in this size of a deal, the partner is basically like the sponsor because they qualify for the loan, and then you do a 50-50 split with that person.
Right.
Okay, got it. Okay. I think I asked everything, and thank you both so much for your time.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. If you think of something, pop back on.
Thank you. You're the best. Bye for now.
Take care. You too.
So, Jeannie, I think there's like a like a 5 second delay. So if someone asks you a question, you might have to wait like 5 seconds, and vice versa. If you ask Jeannie a question, wait 5 seconds till after she's finished, and then you can answer the question. So
I wonder why that is. It never was before.
Technology.
Yeah, you got a delay when you talk to me. I hear that delay.
Okay,
operator,
next on the line we have.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Nope, you go ahead.
Okay, next on the line we have Wesley. Wesley, please go ahead.
Good morning, Jeannie. Good morning, Jermaine.
How are you?
Or actually, it's afternoon where you guys are.
Yes, sir.
Yep.
I forget about that difference. I'm calling because yesterday I've got a property I want to make an offer on. 160 units in Killeen, Texas.
Hey, I saw that. It's beautiful.
Yeah. I've been looking at the numbers.
It's a beautiful property.
Well, one of the things that concerned me that kind of made me go, is this going to last? Is it for real? Is other income is $264,000. And like $40,000 is what they make off charging an override on the cable contract they have and other things like that. And I get to thinking, can I trust other income to last? Like you can trust rent to last because you know that they're going to be there and they're going to pay the rent. But what if new technology comes out next year that eliminates cable and has an easier way? I mean, they have a contract and they're not allowing anybody to put up a satellite, so I know there's no competition in that property. But technology might make competition is what I'm afraid of. That makes sense.
Well, you got to find out how long the contract they have with that cable company is. And if they signed a contract for 5 years, you're safe. They got to pay it.
Oh. Okay.
I don't know. I've had the same cable company for 34 years.
Well, you and I are a little older, Jeannie. And we are used to keeping what we have, whereas the new kids, and this is an area where you have people moving in because they're in the military, you know, they might go for the newest happening thing, and that makes me go, I wonder if cable's going to be there in the near. So maybe I'm just creating a problem. I'm just asking. You know, what I should be aware of and what I should look for. And you tell me the length of the contract.
Wesley, how long have they been getting that cable residual?
That I didn't ask. I only looked at last year's numbers.
Because usually if they're getting it, if it's been over a year, then that's probably income that you can count on. If it's less than a year, I would probably hold off. That would be my opinion, but I don't know. Maybe Jeannie has a different opinion about that.
Yeah, I don't think a year is long enough. I don't think a year is long enough. I think you need to get to the bottom of how long of a contract did they sign for.
Okay.
And you can take that one to the bank.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
What did you put down for a purchase price on that property?
I haven't put anything down yet. I'm submitting tomorrow. LOI is going in tomorrow.
But what are you basing it on? Because they have a TBD on that property.
I don't know that term. What do you mean TBD?
To be determined.
That's Texas.
TBD.
I know that the agent told me that they are hoping to get $9.5 million. They'll take low nines. I'm not going to offer that much.
No, I don't even see that you can offer 8 or 7.5 on it.
Yeah.
How much is your offer going for? The reason why I asked you, somebody sent me that same deal. It's called Twin Creek, right?
Yep.
I mean, it's a beautiful property, but the numbers are not going to support anything above 7.2.
Well, 7.2 is what you get from all the things. It's when the big kicker to go up is that other income, and that's where I'm going. I'm not sure you count on that. You got to do your hard numbers and the basis and all this stuff. Plus the fact Colleen's too reliant on military.
Yeah. But there are a few things going on in that town that are going to be driving jobs.
That is true, too. I had a long talk with an ex-military who stayed in the town and is an agent in the community. And he and I talked a lot about what's going on. There are things happening. And it's the fact... when the previous caller talked about Jacksonville getting so hard, try Dallas, try Atlanta.
Yeah. All of the major cities. It's a pretty small space that we're working. This entire country. It's a pretty small space.
Yeah. Well, that's why I've gone to the secondary and tertiary Dallas markets.
Mm-hmm.
And Colleen falls into that category.
Yeah. I do notice that the expenses are a little bit high.
That I also noticed, and my training tells me that's a good thing for us. You make that a little better, and cash flow works more efficiently. That they were at 52% operating expenses, and sweet spot's, what, 45?
Well, no. In Texas, it's 55% of the income, whatever the income is. And in this case, I'm seeing income at 99.4 and expenses at 56.7, which is too high.
Hey, so you know this deal?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Well, thank
All
you.
Right. You're
yes,
welcome.
Ma'am. Okay.
You know the deal, Jeannie.
I usually don't say anything if I don't know. I just listen.
Our next question comes from Marcia. Marcia, please state your question.
Okay. Hi, everybody. This is Marcia Yude from California. I talked to you, I think it was 2 weeks ago, Jeannie. So this is about a project I'm working on in Decatur, Alabama, near Huntsville.
Yeah.
Kind of boom town there. And at that time, a couple of weeks ago, we had not signed the contract. So now we have signed the purchase contract. I was asking you then about the this project. It's 100 units, and these are large size units. I mean, large for their size. There's 3-bedroom units that are 1,250 square feet. Anyway. So now that we've signed it just a week ago, we're heavily working on the due diligence. And, my husband is a real estate land developer in California. So he's experienced with that. And he used to, at some point in time, he was the head of a company that did track home building in California. But we are not comfortable or experienced with multifamily. We took your, class in December, and the multifamily millions, I guess. And then we took the immersion class in Anaheim in January. So anyway, we're not real experienced with multifamily management. And I am trying to learn a lot about it. I'm listening to your discs, and I'm reading the book, asset management book, and that kind of thing. But we plan on investing some of our own money, and, of course, we're looking for other money in this project. But as I said, we're not entirely comfortable with our abilities at management one way or the other, whether it's, especially this project that has kind of low income, I guess you'd call it. It has 20% Section 8. Anyway, since we've never done it before, I just wondered what you would suggest besides just learning from the book, and if you would have any suggestions for us.
As part of our student base, you can lean on us for a lot of different things. Who helped you analyze the property?
Yes, we're working with Craig Picard, and we've been very happy with him.
I'm not asking if you're happy or unhappy. Did he analyze the details of the property? He looked at the rent rolls. He looked at the expenses, et cetera?
We sent him the underwriting template, and it's all, we're still in the process of confirming all the numbers and that sort of thing. But it's definitely a go with him, at this point. And it's the management, the actual management of a project that we're the least comfortable with. And I don't know if the best way would be get a partner in, or, 100 units is a pretty big deal for somebody who's never managed even one unit. Now, not that I'm going to manage it, of course.
You're not the manager.
No,
you're
not
the manager. You have a management company who puts a property manager on your premises, and your job is to manage that manager.
Yes, but I have to choose a property manager and and perhaps work with them, right? It isn't just a go away and they run the place. I have to work with them as to what's the best way to manage this thing. Like, it's not computerized right now. And the tenants that are there are 50% of them paying green cash. So we have to stop that. And, stuff, a lot of issues like that I guess I have to learn about. So, I mean, the property manager is going to give me feedback, but we have to work together. I'm just feeling a lack of expertise on my own part about that.
Where do you live?
California. California.
Okay. You need boots on the ground, definitely.
Yeah,
somebody that's in or around that area that can really ride by, check out the property, know that, somebody that you trust.
Yes. Well, I have been there before. When I first found out about this property, I went. So that was like almost 2 months ago. And I saw the property in the surrounding area and whatever. We went forward with that. And actually, since we've signed the contract, I'm going out next week to do what you guys say to do, inspect every unit. In fact, inspection is probably too fancy a word. But look at all 100 units, as much as I can tell. I'm not a general contractor nor a engineer or anything, but that's what I'm doing next week. And I'll probably meet with some property managers. But
yeah, you may want to bring the engineer mentality with you.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I'm not.
Somebody that you know?
Pardon me?
Do you have somebody that you know that can go there with you?
You mean an engineer type?
Yeah.
Well, I haven't arranged for that yet. I don't know anybody in town, so it would be a matter of hiring.
How far is Decatur from Huntsville?
I think it's like 20 miles. They're sort of kind of almost combined. The airport, the international airport, is between Decatur and Huntsville, as opposed to on the far side or something. So they're
all right. Well, take down this
yeah.
number. It's my
okay.
number, which is 339-469-5111. Take down the number,
okay.
call me after this call, and I'll give you a few people that I know that are working the Huntsville market, and I'm sure they'll be happy to go with you, and they're Cracker Jacks.
Oh, okay. Great.
Okay.
That'd be perfect. Very good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Next on the line, we have Ben. Ben, please state your question.
Hi, good afternoon. I came across some properties that are portfolios, which is they're kind of like six single-family homes. Some of them are grouped together, but generally in the same neighborhood. Should I be looking at these properties? Are the pros and cons compared to looking at buildings?
Well, it's the same owner, and he's selling a portfolio of properties?
Correct.
You could, usually, and I'm not saying this is the case, but typically when you see a portfolio of properties, one or two properties in there is a dog, and they can't sell them unless they put them into a portfolio.
Okay.
So they'll usually sell... So they'll usually offer the whole bunch, hoping that you won't see the one or two that are dogs. Our suggestion, and what we usually tell students to do, Ben, is to analyze all those deals separately, all those properties separately to see which ones are the dogs, and then that way you may be able to negotiate a better evaluation for yourself if you want to continue.
Okay.
Now, Ben, you did say that they were single-family houses?
Correct.
So how many bedrooms are in each unit?
They varied between two and four bedrooms.
Well, what you might consider, and I don't know what the area is or wherever the properties are, but you might consider opening it up for, like, special needs housing or for battered women's housing, something like that. Maybe change the overall market of the property to include, like, a special needs, because you'd get more rents for that and probably have a better opportunity to make more money than just a single family that, I mean, if they live there for a year, they could move out the following year. But if you get a government program in there, the government's paying the bill, and you could really collect a lot of rents on that. And if they're very large and say they're all on one floor, you could even turn those into like a senior housing, whereas, you know, somebody comes in and does the women's hair, they take them to doctor's appointments. It doesn't have anything to do with nursing or pharmaceuticals, but you could really make a lot of money with that too.
Okay, so that would almost be sort of the same approach as student housing.
Similar, yeah, similar. But with student housing, you're having the parents pay a year-long lease, not the student. But with this, the government is assisting them. So you're getting
your
paint like clockwork.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Welcome.
Up next, we have Lance. Lance, please state your question.
Hi, Jeannie. This is Lance from Chicago. Two quick questions
for
you.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
A few callers ago, you gave out a website to look at the properties. I'm familiar with LoopNet,
yep.
But there was another property, another website you gave out. Can you repeat that?
Sure. Yep. I'll spell it for you. C as in Charlie, R as in Roger, E as in Ernie, X as in xylophone, I as in India. Crexie.com.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. And the my next concern, not really a problem, but my next concern is that the Immersion Bus Tour is coming through Chicago in a couple of weeks, and what should I do? Can you just kind of give me an idea of what I should be preparing myself for, or what the bus tour is about?
Yep, I can, and because I used to teach it.
Oh,
Frank
okay.
Martinez from Chicago will be there too. So Jeff Lindahl and I taught the immersions for a number of years, and then my mother was ill, and I stopped doing them, so Jeff went out on his own, and then he took Faridun with him. So happens with the immersion is it really teaches you how to underwrite a deal. So the first day, you're going to bring a laptop with you, and you're going to have the underwriting template downloaded to your desktop on your laptop. And then we try to have three different people come in. We try to have an economic development committee person come in and talk about what the benefits to buying in certain areas where you're living. And then we have a broker come in. They may or may not have properties for us to look at, but they'll just tell you about the climate and the areas that are heating up and the areas that are getting very, getting a lot of inventory. And then we try to have a property manager come in too, and they let us know what the, general turnovers are, what the perks for buying in that area, and what their company specializes in. That's done on the first day. The second day in the morning, we usually go out to three or four different properties, and we all go on the bus together, and we get to walk these properties. Sometimes we get to meet tenants if they're around or the property management company. Sometimes we just walk the grounds, and we look at the buildings, and we find out, just basically what the good and bad points we see from the outside. If the property manager is on staff on a Saturday, sometimes they'll let us walk some of the units. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes the properties are off-market listings so that you can go back and put in offers. That's happened a time or two on our jaunts throughout Texas. And then we all go to lunch at a local mall and we eat together. We all get, a sandwich or a sub or a piece of pizza. Then we go back to the class and we analyze properties. And we figure out how to read a rent roll, how to really look at a property and pull it apart and see where the value plays are and really learn the story of each property we analyze so that by the time you're done that weekend, you're an expert at underwriting. You can look at a deal and give it a 30-second look and know whether you want to get more involved in that property or not. So that's what happens on the weekend. It is invaluable training, invaluable, because you really are looking at properties And really, if you're working with a partner, make sure you bring that partner with you, because you want them to be on the same page as you are. You want them to understand how to look at a property and pull it apart and find the value play in the property.
So, Lance, so basically what she's saying is that if your weakness is underwriting deals, this is the place. Anybody's weakness, it doesn't have to be you, but anybody, you definitely want to be in that immersion class, because you're going to get a ton from it.
Do not miss this weekend, in other words, I guess.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, don't miss it. Because if you do, you're only harming yourself.
I see. Okay, well, I'll be sure to be there. Thank you so much.
Okay. You're welcome.
Good luck. Say hi to Jeff for us.
Up next, we have Manny. Manny, please state your question.
Hey, Jeannie. How are you?
Manny, I'm fine. How are you? Hey, did you close the 16 unit yet?
The 10 units is coming on the market this week. So I'm excited about putting that for sale. But listen, the reason, the question that I had is, I have an interest in the Tallahassee market, and I went on Crexie, I went on LoopNet, and I really didn't see any brokers who were doing units over 20, were doing over 20 units. And I was just wondering, what other resources would you recommend that I look at so I can start to identify brokers in that area?
I would go to Marcus and Millichap's website and plug in Tallahassee and find out if they have any listings. I'd also go to ARA, which is American Realty Advisors, see if they have anything.
Okay.
And then I like C.B. Richard Ellis, too. Those three brokerage houses usually have the most amount of listings.
Okay. Okay.
And
I'll do that. Thank you.
You could always call Jermaine or myself or Paul and ask if we have any students in that area that you're in.
Okay.
To invest. And we can let you know if they can give their eyes and ears a little once-over and help you out.
Okay, that'd be great. I'll send you guys a note.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Tom. Tom, please state your question.
Hello. Hello. Can you hear?
Tom.
Yep.
Yes.
Hi. How are you, Jeannie?
I'm excellent. Thanks. How are you?
Doing very good. Jeannie, just have a question on underwriting. See, how can I find the performer rental data after rehab? What is the best way to find out after rehab rental amounts?
You just said, if I heard you correctly, you were looking for the pro forma numbers?
Correct, yes. After doing a micro repositioning, how can I find out what would be the potential rent that I could get?
Well, what you're going to do is you're going to look in the area that you're trying to invest in and see some neighboring properties that meet the same criteria as far as square footage, how many bedrooms, how many bathrooms, what the amenities are. If they're the same, then you can pretty much tell that your property is going to be able to command this amount of rent.
Right. So you, what you're saying is take a comparable property that is already updated, right? And look for the rents on those properties.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, thank you so much. And really
you're
glad
welcome.
To see you in the upcoming UP8. I mean,
okay,
UP
me too. It's UP 2018. Yeah.
Yes,
it'll be
yes.
To you too. All right. Good
okay.
talking to you.
Thank you, Jeannie.
Bye-bye.
So another way, Jeannie, that that Tom can project rents is he can do a 5-year projection or a 5-year pro forma. And if he does that, then that will help him as far as knowing what he should be getting in the next 2, 3, 4, and 5 years. So we're actually coming out with that. It's not out yet, but we're actually coming out with it. We're working on it now. So that should be out in the next couple of weeks. A template for a 5-year projection.
Another thing
okay.
is, Manny, make sure you – just 1 second, okay? Manny, make sure you send me this note because I have 3 or 4 people in Tallahassee that I think can help you. All right, operator, I'm ready for the next one.
Next on the line, we have Zane. Zane, please go ahead.
Hey, Jeannie, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I am well. I am well, enjoying, enjoying the good weather here in California, though.
Rubbing it in, you are.
Hey, Jeannie, I heard you guys talking about your, I guess, less reliance on the cap rate and, I guess, and just making sure that you're able to offer investors the that cash-on-cash return. But I guess my question is, I mean, a low cap rate, you know, indicates to me that, you know, some indication of whether I'm overpaying for something based on where the market is. And on a shorter hold period, 3 to 5 years, it seems like I should pay quite a bit of attention because the next time I go to sell this, I might have to look for somebody to pay me more than what I paid for it. So I got to look for that, you know, that greater fool next time. If I paid on a 5% cap rate, that the next time I sell it, I might have to sell it at a 4, so higher than it was now.
Right. No, I know what you're saying. It's just for me, when I'm looking at a deal, the last thing I look at is the cap rate. I always look at the cash on cash return because if I concentrate on the cap rate, I probably would never find a deal because the owners are looking for the most amount of money that they can get on a property. But if I'm looking for a value play on a property, say I look at a property, it's 100 units, and the last time they increased rents was 2 years ago. And you can see based on the rent roll that half the place is month to month because the property manager is just too lazy to go and get these people on leases, which is very risky. So if I'm going to go through it, I do my underwriting as what it is right now, and then I do the underwriting with what I'm going to make it. And usually what I'm going to make it is going to have a better cap rate than what I'm looking at right now. But I base everything on the cash-on-cash return because we're going to commit to the investors an 8% preferred rate of return before we take a penny. So if you're just looking at the cap rate, you're never going to be able to give somebody the 8% preferred rate of return. I mean, you might be able to give it to them, but you're not going to make any money, not even a nickel. So I always do 2 sets of underwriting if it's a property that I'm thinking of buying.
That's helpful, and that's what I've been finding, is that, you know, that looking at trying to find the Holy Trinity, so to speak, and just, I mean, most everything that I'm finding is really in the fives already as far as what they're, you know, what's being offered.
Yep.
Okay. Okay. Good to know. Thanks, Gina. I just wanted some, a little bit more detail. Thank you.
Okay.
But usually, Jeannie, if you're looking at it, if you find something that has like a 5 cap rate, it normally doesn't have a 12 cash on cash return. So, and usually if you're able to get a 12 cash on cash return, the cap rate's pretty decent, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually it falls in line with each other. But
now, I have seen it where it's been, you know, a high cap rate with a low cash-on-cash return. So, but I understand what you're saying. It rarely happens, but.
Yep.
Any other questions, operator?
Okay, our next question comes from Meredith. Meredith, please state your question.
Hi, Jeannie. Hi, Jermaine. It's Meredith out in Sacramento.
Hi, Meredith. How was things last night?
Good. I'm working on some stuff.
Good.
Underwriting. Not, but I had a question. I couldn't attend the private money boot camp, but I will be at the next one in October. But I was just wondering if you could explain the importance of the accredited investor form and if you have any recommendations for what we should say to a potential private investor to kind of explain to them why we're sending them that form. Because I guess I'm in the process of, you know, building relationships with multiple people who might be interested in investing in a deal when we have one. But I don't want to send that form to anyone kind of prematurely to put them off.
Well, what I would tell them is I do have properties that I can discuss with you, but I want to be SEC compliant. So I would like for you to fill out this form. I know we've met in the past, and I'm free to share things with you, but I just want to make sure I'm doing the right thing. Would you mind filling out the form? And most people don't mind.
Got it. So is it we use the form then when we already have a deal in mind?
Yeah. You use the form whenever you're going to offer up any kind of returns. You want to have that form because what if they work for the SEC?
Yeah. So at the phase I'm at right now, there isn't any particular deal that I have, and I'm just getting them excited about multifamily and wanting to have the opportunity to look at future deals. So in that scenario, is it too premature to send them an accredited investor form?
Nope.
Okay.
If you fill this out, as soon as I have a deal that meets the Holy Trinity criteria that we buy on, I'd love to be able to send it to you. But if I'm not SEC compliant, I'm afraid that I wouldn't be able to.
Okay. That's very helpful. That makes sense.
And phrase it as if it's for their protection. So that way they're thinking that you're trying to, which it is for their protection also, but you're trying to help them out, make sure that they're protected in this deal.
Okay, that's perfect. Okay, great. Thank you. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Operator, any more questions?
Okay. There appears to be no further questions at this time.
Ooh.
Well, I have a couple more that were sent in. I'm going to read the short ones. From Robert Gunther in Richmond, Virginia. Is there a difference between a partnership and syndication? And if so, can you explain? Yeah, I can. A partnership is when you take a deal and you're bringing one or two people into the deal. Those people are going to put up the money. You're going to run the deal. when you have more than two people in a deal that's bringing money, it's now a syndication. And it requires a PPM, an operating agreement, a subscription agreement, a questionnaire. All of these documents are drafted up by an SEC attorney. It costs money, but whenever you're pooling three or more people into a deal, you need to syndicate. So you'd be creating a EIN number or a LLC of the property. You'll have articles of organization. You'll have a property package. You'll have an operating agreement, subscription agreement, questionnaire, et cetera, so that you can pool together other people's money into a deal. And that's the difference. Partnerships are great, but when you need to raise $1 or $2 million, I mean, it's very hard to do with one or two people. So most people do syndicate the deal. This other question comes from John Stevens from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Says, Dave, when should you get a sponsor for the deal? Should you get the sponsor before the LOI or before the contract? Well, it depends. I mean, you could do it before the LOI because some sponsors want to be in the deal prior to you sending the LOI, or you could do it after the LOI is signed and then you, before you go to purchase and sale, maybe during the walkthrough, you want to make sure that the sponsor is with you so that he gets excited about the deal and you know you have one because you're going to need one. And the sponsor's real responsibility is to qualify you for the mortgage and to have up to 6 months liquidity in mortgage payments. A lot of times people think, oh, the sponsor's going to put up all the money. Oh, the sponsor's going to raise the money. That's not true. Some will, some won't. Their real responsibility is to qualify you for the note. Any questions, operator?
Nope, there appears to be no further questions at this time.
Okay, I only have one more question, and then we're going to say bye-bye for today. So my questions are how to structure the possible equity sharing with a private lender. I understand the equity share part. Let's assume loan of 80% from the bank and 20% from private lender. This is from Diego Rodriguez from New York. Number one, if 20% of the down payment and acquisition expenses will come from private lender, then this will give them 20% equity share at time of sale. No, it doesn't work like that. In fact, you've got one, two, and three, and none of them work the way you're talking. So if you have a deal that meets the Holy Trinity, which is a 12% cash-on-cash return, a debt coverage ratio of 1.6 or higher, and a cap rate of 8 or higher. The bank looks at your deal as two sides of the coin. The first side of the coin is the investors. They are called the A-class members. They're going to get 75 or 80% of the deal. I'm sorry, 70 or 75% of the deal, and you're going to get 25 or 30% of the deal. So the investors are going to put up the money. They're going to put up, you know, whatever the down payment on the property is, plus closing costs, plus loan points, plus any CapEx monies that you know you need to get the deal closed. We typically tell people to have 2 months of expenses and a whole year of CapEx and closing costs other. So let's just talk a small property of $3 million. Your down payment is probably going to be $700,000 plus closing costs plus CapEx. So maybe you're going to raise $1 million on a $3 million property. The investors put up the money. You get your carve out. They get their carve out. When the dollars come in the bank, they get 70%. You get 30%. Or if you need a sponsor, you're sharing your side with your sponsor. So it's you have a bank loan, but the investors get the lion's share of the cash coming in, unless the property is so amazingly fruitful. Like we had a property in North Carolina, and the cash and cash return was 17.4% year one, but it turned out it was 17.4% to the investors and to Dave and his partner. So it was a 50-50 split. By the time we finished all the due diligence, we figured out that they hadn't raised rents on the property in almost 5 years, and the property was amazingly clean and really done well. So we cashed out after 4 years in the property, and the investors got triple whatever they put in for their return. So it just depends on the kind of deal you find. But the structure that, Diego, you're thinking of does not work on these syndication deals. All right, we're going to ask the operator one more time if she has any questions, and then we're going to say bye-bye.
There are no questions at this time.
Okay, Rashawn, thank you so much for today. Everybody, enjoy the sunshine. We're due for some 65-degree weather tomorrow.
Yay!
Far cries from 34 and 38 this morning when I left. I got here at 5 minutes of 7, and when I got out of my car, it was 36 degrees, so it was crazy. And I anticipate tomorrow's going to be in the 60s, and we might hit 70 on Saturday, and then on Sunday we tank again. So don't shut your heat off, everybody on the East Coast here, because we're going back to due for some snow on Sunday possibly. All right, everybody, have a good one. Thank you for joining me on the call and for asking all your good questions. Bye-bye now.
See you later, guys. Enjoy your weekend.